If you want to believe the world is a happy place full of friendly people, you should probably stay off Twitter. And that's not the only place you'll see people saying terrible things to and about one another. It can often appear as if simple human kindness has become a rare thing, that we have no capacity for empathy anymore. Our guest this hour is not buying it. Jamil Zaki walks us through scientific findings about empathy and many stories of its uses. His book is The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Jamil Zaki is a professor of psychology at Stanford University and the director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Laboratory. Dr. Zaki has had his writing published in the likes of The New Yorker and The Atlantic, as well as in this book. Jamil Zaki, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I wondered where you were going in your opening story of the bitter divorce you experienced of your parents, but you really surprised me. You say you're filled with gratitude for them. Why?
Yeah, so my parents come from different countries, my father from Pakistan and my mother from Peru, and they actually met in Washington State. And, you know, they I think, got together and sort of fell in love, partially because they were both so foreign and felt foreign in the U.S. But as they became more comfortable in the U.S., they, I think, realized how little they actually had in common and had this kind of long and difficult divorce. I'm their only child, and so I kind of spent a lot of my childhood bouncing back and forth between their worlds, and it was really difficult for me to sort of acclimate and figure out how to interact with each of them productively. And that was not an easy time in my life, but the reason, to your question, that I experience gratitude when I think back to that time is because I think of my parents' divorce as an empathy gym for me. It really forced me to work at care and understanding, and I feel like that ability to empathize and to stretch myself to understand and connect with two very different people turned out to be, you know, the most important skill I ever developed in my life.
So you think your empathy might have been less well developed if your parents had had a happy marriage?
It's an interesting question. It might have been developed in a different way, right? I mean, I think that we all empathize in different ways. But for me, one thing that was really powerful about their particular situation was that it forced me to understand that two people who were coming from very different places and believed and felt very different things could both be experiencing real and deep emotions and could be experiencing lived realities that mattered. You know, I think that if your family is basically all in agreement all the time, which I've never met a family that's actually like that, but if your family was all in agreement all the time, then you wouldn't have that same challenge, if that makes sense.
It does. So the point is that when you're faced with having to use your empathy, you develop that muscle a little better, it sounds like.
That's right.
So empathy and kindness are not the same thing, you point out, but you say empathy inspires kindness. How would you define kindness?
Yeah, so kindness is a type of behavior, and empathy is a kind of experience, right? So kindness is anything that I do for you or you do for me that's designed to improve someone else's well-being. So, you know, donating to charity or helping a friend move, those are behaviors that are kind and even altruistic. Empathy is an experience. It's the reaction that we have to somebody else's emotion, whether we're feeling what they feel or thinking about what they feel or caring about what they feel. And those experiences of empathy inspire kind action.
Okay, so you got to have the empathy before you have the kindness then, though?
You know, I'm not sure I would say that. You could act kindly because you feel obligated, for instance, or because you're legally obliged to do so. Empathy is one of the more powerful sort of psychological sources of kindness, though.
So, Jamil, you say that kindness puzzled Charles Darwin. Why was he sort of scratching his head about it?
Well, it kind of feels, I mean, if you think about Darwin's theory of evolution, the idea is supposed to be that we all compete with each other, isn't it, right? I mean, that's one read of natural selection, is that it's survival of the fittest, and you really have to look out for yourself in order to survive in that cruel world, right? Red in tooth and claw, as it was once described. And so in that world, someone who acts to benefit other people instead of themselves might not benefit. You know, I think Darwin said he who was willing to give up his life to save a comrade would leave no offspring to inherit his noble nature. In other words, you know, the person who acts heroically, who acts altruistically, they might be remembered well, but that's all they'll be, is remembered. And it didn't seem to Darwin like that was a great recipe for surviving.
And yet, as he looked around and as people look around still, I mean, how common do they find what appears to be kindness to be among animals, not humans?
I mean, kindness is prevalent among animals, right? So rats, for instance, will give up chocolate to save a cage mate who's been trapped. Mice exhibit signs of empathy. And then as you get sort of more towards humanity in the animal kingdom, you get a lot more kindness. So chimpanzees, gorillas, elephants, dolphins, all of these animals act in ways that are kind and pro-social.
Empathy helped us take over the planet, you write, that it made our brains big and allowed us to work cooperatively, all that stuff. So how did society get to a point where it appears that we're actually pretty good now at breaking empathy?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I do want to give us some credit, right? I've just said that all these other animals exhibit signs of kindness, but no animal at all comes close to humanity in this regard. I mean, we can talk, and I'm sure we will, about why modern society makes empathy difficult. But let's remember that, you know, in just the U.S., people donated just hundreds of billions of dollars to charity, and they do every year, and donate for billions of hours, right, just in the U.S. And, you know, we act kindly towards people who we will never meet, who are thousands of miles away. So it's not as though humanity's capacity for empathy is all gone. We are the most empathic species on the planet. We're the world champions of empathy. That said, as you put it nicely in your introduction, you don't have to look very far to find humanity engaging in callousness and cruelty either. And I think there are lots of pieces of modern life that make empathy difficult. So, for instance, people are more isolated than we were in the past. More people live alone than ever in human history. We live more in cities, which are not always conducive to a sense of community. And we interact more than ever on the internet, where we are anonymous and where the incentives around how we communicate don't always favor kindness.
Yeah, we don't use the filters on the internet that we use with each other in person, or at least usually use with each other in person. And Jamil, I want to bring in the point that it's not just people looking at other people's behavior and saying, people aren't nice to each other anymore. What do people self-report about their own empathy now?
Yeah, so there was the most famous measure of empathy is just a questionnaire. It's a set of statements like, I often have tender, concerned feelings for people less fortunate than me. And you say how well that statement describes you from 1 to 5. And a bunch of these statements together give you a empathy score that it runs between 1 and 5. And hundreds of thousands of people have filled out that questionnaire over the years. And recently, psychologists found that people's self-reported empathy has been declining rapidly. So in 1979, the average American got about a 4 out of 5 on that scale. And in 2009, the average American got about a 3 out of 5 on that scale, which is a big drop. So the average American in 2009 scoring as less empathic than 75% of people just 30 years before. I mean, it's really quite a alarming decline for me. I feel like, especially since empathy helps people so much, studying empathy these days as a psychologist feels a little bit like being a climate scientist studying the polar ice caps, right? Like we've discovered the value of something just as it disappears all around us.
But I'm going to guess you would not have written this book if you think we're stuck in a downward spiral that we can't get out of.
That would have been a depressing 3 years of my life. No, I don't think that we have to give up. I think the fact that empathy has declined shows us something. There's a hopeful message hidden in that dark message, which is that empathy is malleable. It can change. And that message in and of itself is different than what a lot of people think. People assume that parts of our psychology, like how smart we are or how empathic we are like fixed traits that you can never change. You either have it or you don't. But it turns out that psychological research and neuroscientific research suggests that empathy is also something like a skill. Yeah, it's partially genetic, but our experiences shape how empathic we are, and our choices can allow us to build our empathy on purpose. And I think that, you know, that's one way that each one of us, and collectively all of us, can push back against sort of the receding or eroding empathy that we see around us.
And you can probably develop it in nicer circumstances than having your parents engage in a bitter divorce, for example. We'll get to the hows in a little bit. I want to come back to the title of the book. I mean, the War for Kindness. Do we have to fight to be kinder to one another?
Well, you know, that was not the original title of the book when I started it 3.5 years ago. But, you know, it was interesting. I was just writing about the ways that individuals could try to become more empathic. But, you know, it really felt like I was like I wasn't speaking to the trends that I saw all around me as I was writing this sort of rosy account of becoming a kinder person. Or I felt like all around me I was seeing examples of people acting so unkindly. And I realized that there are social forces like the, you know, the way that social media is set up or the sort of increasing extremism that we see on cable news that are really pulling us apart. And I do feel as though we should acknowledge that in order to be a kind person these days, we do have to fight back against those trends. I think that empathy is in a way a radical act these days.
Going against a trend in the other direction, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. You come back several times to the Roddenberry hypothesis. We're talking about Gene Roddenberry, the creator of the Star Trek series. What is that hypothesis?
Yeah, I decided early on that I would out myself as a huge dork. I feel like if you end up being a neuroscientist, maybe as a teenager you might have been free on Saturday nights. I certainly was as an 8 to 12 year old, and so I would watch every weekend. I would look forward to Star Trek: The Next Generation. It was my favorite TV show, and it's the first place, by the way, that I heard the word empathy. So there are these two characters in that show. One of them is the ship's counselor, Deanna Troi, who is known throughout the galaxy for her empathy. She sort of automatically catches people's emotions and can understand what other people feel. And then on the other side, there was my favorite character, Data, who is an android and couldn't feel emotions and therefore was colorblind to what other people felt. And, you know, an important thing about these characters is that they couldn't choose how empathic they were. In Deanna Troi's case, she's a Betazoid, so it's like hard-coded into her genes that she has to empathize. And in Data's case, it was literally hardwired into his positronic net that he couldn't empathize, right? And so I guess the idea here is that neither one of those people could change how empathic they were. And the Roddenberry hypothesis, as I see it, and it's not just Star Trek, it's all over psychology. The idea is that we each have some level of empathy between those two characters. And just like our adult height or the color of our eyes, we can't do anything to change that. And that might be okay if you're already empathic, but if you're unempathic, that's bad news, because no matter what you do or how hard you try, you won't be able to connect better. And I also think that's a depressing message for our times, because if we feel like there are big social trends that are making it harder to empathize, then there's nothing that we can do collectively to overcome those barriers.
Ah, and here you are making the case that we can, in fact, push ourselves a bit. The book is called The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Author Jamil Zaki is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Jamil, you tick off a list here of changes in personality as we reach adult milestone. How big are those changes?
Yeah, so again, I think that the idea that we can change our empathy is part of a larger idea, which is that human nature itself is more malleable than we often realize. So for instance, people think of intelligence as something that's fixed, but every year of education that you achieve raises your IQ by 1 point, which are changes that last a lifetime. And likewise, there are changes that occur in our personality, like, you know, people become, I believe, less extroverted after getting married, and going through psychotherapy, for instance, makes people less neurotic. Those changes are not huge, right? So it's not like you're going to go from the most neurotic person who you know to the least neurotic person who you know by going through a course of psychotherapy, but the changes are notable and they last a long time.
So there's nothing physiologically or evolutionary that stops us from being kinder.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there are features of modern life that make it harder, right? So empathy and kindness come most naturally, for instance, when we're really familiar with the people we interact with, or when we're accountable to them, right? When they can see our actions and we can see theirs. Think about modern life, right? A lot of the times, the people that we run into are not familiar to us, right? So living in cities, for instance, you see a ton of strangers. And on the internet, you're not accountable to other people, right? Oftentimes, we're anonymous to each other. And so the way I put it is that the rules of social life that make empathy come naturally are oftentimes gone in the way that we interact with each other these days. That doesn't make it physiologically impossible, as you say, to empathize or to be kind. It just isn't structured in a way that makes it come very naturally to us.
But, you know, there are many cases in the book, and we'll start here with some of them, about where people have been through some really awful things and have even caused some really awful things and yet still managed to find some empathy in them. You cite, for example, cases in which people endure major trauma and then help others through similar experiences.
Yeah, this is the idea known as altruism born of suffering, right? So people who undergo trauma oftentimes have PTSD, right? They're sort of scarred by those experiences for sometimes for their whole lives. But there are other cases in which people who endure trauma also become sort of sensitized to the suffering of others and turn around and help those people. So one example of this is the Cajun Navy. This is a group of people who, after Hurricane Katrina, sort of took to their boats and helped people. These are New Orleans residents, took to their boats and helped people and, you know, rescued people. They were undergoing great trauma themselves as well. And when Hurricane Harvey hit Texas, those same people, the Cajun Navy, sort of trucked over all their boats and helped people in Houston, right? So there's sort of this tradition, and that, of course, that's not the only example. People who have suffered from addiction often become addiction counselors. People who have suffered from sexual assault often become assault counselors, right? People devote their lives to helping others recover from the same traumas they endured.
And is there an assumption that people who've been through traumas need to recover and keep their resources for themselves? I mean, or is this fairly common that people do help the people behind them who've suffered the same sort of trauma?
Yeah, so that type of helping, that type of altruism born of suffering is extremely common. There's a beautiful book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell that's about people's responses to disasters. And what she finds is that the assumption that a lot of people have, and this is something perpetuated in media as well, right? If you look at movies about disasters, a lot of the time people sort of become savages, right, and start looting and killing each other. But in fact, if you look at the historical data, during disasters, people are incredibly altruistic. They build communities out of scratch and act with extreme levels of kindness. So I think an interesting thing is that our assumption is often that trauma turns us inward. But in fact, in many cases, not all of course, but in many cases, trauma and difficult circumstances turn us outward towards each other.
Jamil Zaki is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Laboratory and a professor of psychology at Stanford University. His book is called The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Come on in here and talk about what you think about the state of empathy and kindness in the world and what we can do, if anything, to improve upon it. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When we are altruism born of suffering or any other thing in which we deliver kindness to somebody, how much do our biases get in the way in any circumstance, though? Are we more generous and kind with our tribe? Is it easier for us to take care of our perceived group than others?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is one of the oldest pieces of human psychology, is our tendency to divide the world into us and them and feel more favorably towards us's as compared to them's. And, you know, this is not an inherently negative thing. Evolutionarily, for instance, it might be a good strategy to focus on our own tribe, sometimes to the exclusion of others. But, you know, in today's world where we have the opportunity and some would say the responsibility to sort of try and care for and help people, even if they're in other nations or are different from us, this sort of tribalism is a huge barrier. That said, it's also not impossible to overcome. In the book, I talk about what's known as contact theory. This is the idea that when we befriend or make a deep connection with one individual who comes from a different group, we actually develop greater empathy for that entire group, and we sort of start to dissolve those boundaries between us and them.
So a representative of that group in contact with us helps us understand or at least get feelings for the whole group.
Yeah, there was a study out of UCLA that looked at college freshmen, and they found that freshmen who are randomly assigned to a roommate of a different race exhibit less race bias at the end of their freshman year, right? And so these are not freshmen who were already open-minded and wanted a roommate of a different race. This is through random assignment. So it's a really interesting piece of data that, again, suggests that just one representative of a different group can open you up to that group as a whole.
Boy, one sentence in this part of the book sure jumped out about people we think of as statistics and strangers. That's like a double whammy, isn't it?
It really is, you know, and, you know, there's that famous quote sometimes attributed to Stalin, although I don't think that's necessarily right, that one death is a tragedy and a million deaths is a statistic. And that certainly, there's a lot of data that suggests that people find it a lot easier to empathize with one image, one person, than they do with lots of people, which can get us in moral trouble because lots of people need our help more than any one individual.
Oh, but we see the one crying child or even dead child in a recent case, and we respond very, very forcefully.
That's right.
Let us take some phone calls here. Let's start with Melody in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jamil Zaki. Melody there?
Howdy. I'm in Myrtle Point.
Oh, Myrtle Point.
Out towards Coos Bay. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to bring up the point y'all had mentioned, or rather he did, the disasters in Hurricane Harvey and such.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a native Texan, and I'm used to natural disasters and what have you. I was there especially for Ike. But something that we don't seem to take into account, or you haven't mentioned, is that it isn't kindness. We don't go and help people because it's kindness necessarily. We're not doing it because it's something that feels empathetic. It is instead more of an obligation. I wouldn't consider myself utilitarian, but it's more of an obligation to instantly just help everyone because you know that those people that aren't used to it won't be able to help themselves.
All right. I appreciate the perspective of that. Thank you, Melody. Appreciate that. Jamil, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, it's a great question, and thank you for sharing. You know, I think one of the interesting things about kindness is that sometimes people don't experience it as kindness, but that doesn't change the fact that their behavior helps other people. There's this great sort of program called the Carnegie Heroes Foundation that rewards people for extreme acts where they put their own lives at risk to help others. So these are like folks who jump on a subway platform to save somebody who's had a seizure and fallen down, or people pulling each other out of burning cars after an accident. And these folks don't think of themselves as heroes often. They don't say, oh, you know, I figured that, you know, it would be a great thing for me to do to help this person. They just act. They act almost impulsively. I've always thought that that is, in fact, quite beautiful, the fact that our instincts drive us in this way. And again, you know, I feel like disasters are a place that allow our better human instincts to shine.
Another call here from Brian and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jamil Zaki.
Well, hi. Oh, I love the, you know, boy, morning and hearing about Star Trek Next Generation has made my day. So thank you. But, you know, but I think that the interesting thing with the data analogy, and I just forgot her name, but the signal wasn't there at all for data. And I think that there's, you know, my idea, and this is Melody's comment a little bit too, is that there, a lot of people have a signal in the sense they understand or they can begin to see how other people feel, but that doesn't translate into, I guess, that, you know, the empathy. Or maybe they understand how the other person feels and go, that's fine, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, that empathy connection, and I think that her comment about that sense of community and obligation is a really rich area. I commend you for having this conversation because we all sort of live on some spectrum disorder, I think, in this world right now, with a lot of people with 700 friends and yet feel totally isolated. So thank you. And you know, my area of neuroscience was circadian biology and really core driven behaviors. And I like that connection too. So
okay, thanks for the call, Ryan. Good to hear from you.
So much to say to that. I mean, that was a really rich comment. You know, I think it was Kurt Vonnegut who once wrote about a neurosurgeon who, on his deathbed, writes this, says to his wife, you know, I was a radio repairman. The idea being that our brains are really sort of devices for picking up signals from the outside. And I think that we all have the capability to pick up signals from each other. I think that one analogy that I could use is that modern life is basically running interference on those signals in a way, and sometimes making it harder for us to pick up what other people are feeling, or making it harder for us to care about what they're feeling, even if we understand it. But again, you know, I think that there are ways that we can push back against that.
He is writing about empathy and how it inspires kindness in a book called The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. He's making a case that a lot of people have made, including a lot of people self-reporting this, that empathy is just not what it used to be. People aren't feeling it like they used to. The people are not as nice to each other as they used to be. We're talking about ways to change that. The fact that we do have some flexibility within our realm. We're not stuck in a one mode of empathy for life. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's get into the issue of stresses that can reduce empathy. Empathy in a hurry, for example, in Darley and Batson's experiment at Princeton.
This is a classic experiment where they recruited seminary students. So these are and asked them to write a sermon about the Good Samaritan, right? The parable in which someone is assaulted and left for dead on the side of the road, and a Good Samaritan sort of decides to help them. And so these folks wrote this sermon, right, about how important it is to help a stranger, and then they were asked to go across campus to deliver that sermon. Now, the trick was that sometimes Darley and Batson told them, you've got plenty of time, so take your time and walk over, enjoy the campus. And in other cases, they said, you're running late, so you need to hurry up and get there. Then Darley and Batson then planted a person that was sort of sitting in the doorway of the building these seminary students had to enter. And this person seemed like they were in trouble, like they maybe homeless, maybe they were sick. And what they measured, the person was actually an actor, they measured how often the student stopped to help that individual. What they found was that when the student was not in a rush, they helped about 70% of the time. When they were in a rush, they helped only 10% of the time, which is a vast irony, right? I mean, this is basically saying, I'm sorry, I can't stop to help you. I'm in too much of a rush to deliver a sermon about how important it is to help people when they're in need.
So it's there are conditions then. I mean, you think you can squeeze empathy a little bit and produce less kindness in essence.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, stress is one of the things that I think is really a barrier to empathy in modern life. And it's ironic because people, when they are stressed, feel as though they have to focus on themselves. They feel like they don't have energy to help other people. But it turns out that when we do help other people, we actually benefit ourselves as well. There's a great study that showed that when people spend time on others, they actually feel less like they're squeezed for their own time afterwards. They feel what these researchers call time affluence. I recently taught a class at Stanford called Becoming Kinder that had these kindness challenges based, sort of like practical exercises based on the stuff in the book. And one of them, I asked my students to spend time helping other people, and all of them thought, gosh, I'm so busy. If I spend time on other people, I'll be even more squeezed. And they were shocked that they felt better, more relaxed, more energized after giving to other people. So when in our stressed out state, we decide that we don't have time for other people, we're ironically depriving ourselves of one of the best ways that we could feel better.
I'll ask about specific practices in a little bit, Jamil, but just in general, I mean, can we prompt our own increase in empathy? Is it kind of like the question, can you tickle yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are lots of practices, and I'm happy to talk about them later, that can increase our empathy. One thing that I want to stress is that the first step towards increasing our empathy is understanding that we can. In one set of studies, my colleague Carol Dweck and I introduced people to the idea that we convinced people either empathy is a fixed trait that you can't change, or empathy is a skill that you can build. And then we introduced folks to what we called an empathy obstacle course, different situations that might make it hard for people to care about each other. And what we found is that when people believed that empathy was a skill, they worked harder at it. right? So, for instance, they spent more time listening to the struggles of someone of a different race and more energy trying to understand the opinions of someone who they disagreed with politically. So the idea here is that the Roddenberry hypothesis might actually be getting in our way, because just thinking of empathy as a trait makes us feel like, well, if I can't work on it, if I can't change my empathy, why bother trying? Whereas if we understand that it's a skill, that gives us the opportunity and the responsibility to empathize with purpose.
Let's take another call here. Howard in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jamil Zaki, the author of The War for Kindness.
My question has to do about the issue about people who are just not able to feel empathy because they've been diagnosed either with autism or Asperger's syndrome, and the neurological damage that caused that, and therefore they're just not able to feel empathy. Second part of the question is, I wonder how much of our lack of empathy may be due to us collectively or even individually suffering from empathy fatigue.
Okay, excellent questions. Thanks for that, Howard.
Yeah, two great questions. So I'll speak first to the autism spectrum disorders question. People with ASD do struggle with some parts of empathy, but let me be clear that they don't necessarily struggle with all of empathy. So people with autism spectrum disorders sometimes have trouble figuring out what other people are feeling. That's what we call cognitive empathy. But at both the psychological and brain level, they do appear to be able to experience emotional empathy, for instance, sharing what other people feel, and they are certainly capable of kind and concerned behavior, absolutely. Second, there is some evidence that in people with autism spectrum disorders, empathy can nonetheless be trained. And so there's all sorts of practices to do that, many of which I write about in the book. In terms of empathy fatigue, gosh, I absolutely think that's a factor in making empathy difficult in modern life. There was a poll conducted last year that found that 7 out of 10 Americans have news fatigue, right? I mean, we have access to the emotions and suffering of people all around the world, and that's a great opportunity because we can feel compassion for them and help. It's also a great risk because it can just become too much. And, you know, there's an entire chapter in the book about empathizing too much and the ways that, in fact, you know, I don't suggest in the book or elsewhere that we all turn our empathy up to 11 all the time. That would be completely unsustainable. Rather, I try to suggest ways that we can work with our empathy and try to empathize better, not necessarily to empathize more.
Let's talk about someone who didn't display a lot of empathy for a long time. Tony McAleer, what's he doing in your book?
Yeah, Tony's story is amazing and difficult, right? So Tony came from a really difficult home, sort of had a really rough childhood, and ended up falling into a terrible crowd, sort of got into white supremacist music, and then ended up being a participant in hate groups in Canada, and eventually one of the leaders of Canada's basically neo-Nazi movement. He was a person who suffered a lot and caused a lot of suffering in others. A remarkable thing about Tony, though, is that he escaped that life. Earlier we talked about how befriending someone who's different from us can open us up. That's what happened to Tony. He befriended a Jewish man, not knowing that the guy was Jewish, and ended up confessing to that man that his anti-Semitic activities. That man, Dov is his name, didn't judge Tony, but instead showed him compassion and said, you know, that's what you did, but that's not who you are. I see you. And receiving compassion from this person, where Tony didn't feel like he deserved a shred of compassion from Dov, receiving it really opened Tony up. I mean, he spent like the next half hour crying with Dov. And then after that, basically that set him on a path to reform. And Tony since then started, along with his colleagues, a group called Life After Hate, which is an organization meant to pull other people out of hate groups. But all the people in it, in the organization, were former hate group members themselves. And their stories are, you know, fascinating and inspiring, and to me show that even people who seem like they're the most lost, the least capable of empathy, can still be brought back.
There's some interesting stuff in here about Tony McAleer saying you can empathize with a hate group member, not share their beliefs. So there's some just, you know, we're humans together kind of thing. But then there's this other smack upside the head in this chapter about we can accept other races and sexual preferences, but we often don't want our kids dating people from other political parties. What do we learn from that? Do we have to hate something?
I mean, tribalism is evolves and changes just like we do, right? And so the divisions that are most salient in one time in our, you know, in our culture are not necessarily the ones that are most salient at another time. And I think that these days politics is absolutely, you know, America's empathic black hole. I do think that people are built such that we respond naturally to an us and a them, but it's not necessarily obvious how large or small the us or them can be. And one thing that I think psychologists are thinking a lot about is, can we make ourselves part of an us, a tribe, that is bigger? So, for instance, not just Republicans or Democrats, not just Californians and Oregonians, but, you know, maybe Americans, maybe people. One thing that I think a lot about is the collective threat that all of humanity is facing in the form of climate change. Right. And I wonder whether that could be a them that would make us really large. Right. And
we do pretty well with a common enemy, don't we?
We do. I mean, there's this movie, you know, again, I'm a sci-fi dork. So Independence Day, I don't know if you remember.
Oh, sure.
This
yeah.
Where these aliens sort of blow up all of the world's major cities. And it's obviously tragic, but also brings people together. And there's this iconic scene of this Israeli and Iraqi fighter jet flying next to each other against, you know, sort of ready to take on this alien horde. Right. And I think that's right, that if we have a common enemy, that's one way that we can come together. I don't know that the common enemy has to be human. I don't want an alien invasion, let me be clear, but but there are other common threats that we might be facing.
And as you point out, climate change could be that. Let's take a call from Gail in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jamil Zaki.
Hi. I really appreciate this this episode on the DefNet. I had a recent birthday, but I was recruited to help celebrate the life activities and achievements of one of the chiefs at Warm Springs, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. And I groused about it, like, well, it's my birthday. But I went ahead and made a huge cake and lots of food, and I received lots of feedback and warm birthday wishes, and I'd forgotten how wonderful it feels to give. And so it was a real adventure for me to do something else besides for myself on my birthday. And it was wonderful. I had the best birthday ever.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that, Gail.
That's awesome. I love that. And again, you know, I want to drive home the point that empathy and kindness often feel like they're for other people, but they're also for us, right? I mean, there's just reams of evidence suggesting that empathic people benefit from feeling empathy, and kind people benefit from acting kindly. And so, I mean, not to say that we should be kind for selfish reasons, but we benefit everybody, including ourselves, when we act in these ways. And so, I mean, I think that it's just very important for listeners to remember that really acting kindly is, even if we feel like we've lost our way, acting kindly, feeling empathy is, in a deep way, who we are. And being who you are is a rewarding thing to do.
Well, and you buttress what you're talking about in the book, where you say that the process of rebuilding relations, particularly with people where they've been shattered, like in Rwanda, is building compassion for themselves first.
That's right, yeah. And oftentimes we forget that one of the people to whom we need to be kind is ourselves, right? And so this is, you know, I talk about this a lot when I discuss empathy fatigue and compassion fatigue, right? Which is relevant to another caller's comments, right? That sometimes we feel as though we just need to listen to everybody and feel for everybody, and there's so much suffering around us, and we're bad people if we enjoy ourselves at all. That's also not true, right? I mean, we do need to take time to empathize with and feel compassion for ourselves. And in fact, that's the beginning of being kind to others.
So about a minute left. Is there a short list for how we can practice improving our empathy, Jamil?
I can do better than that. So I've created a series of kindness challenges that I'll be releasing, one per day starting next week. So if you want to sort of take the ideas from the book, the ideas from this call, and try them out yourself, you can find them at warforkindness.com/challenges or on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. They're going to be all over. We're going to be running them all next week. People can try to work out their own kindness and empathy. Go to your own empathy gym starting next week.
The warforkindness.com/challenges?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, all kinds of great stuff in here. The book is called The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. It's the work of Jamil Zaki, who's a professor of psychology at Stanford University and the director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Laboratory. Jamil, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
That was delightful. Thanks for having me.